Today's guest is one of the most admired film directors of the last 50 years. He's twice won the Palme d'Or Prize at the Cannes Film Festival, first for The Wind That Shakes the Barley in 2006, and then a decade later for I, Daniel Blake. His 1969 film, Kes, was voted the seventh greatest British film of the 20th century by the British Film Institute. Ken Loach, welcome to Great Lives. Shall we start with some music?
You know, gold diggers all stand up now, stand up now. You know, gold diggers all stand up now. Your wastelands to maintain.
That's a pretty hefty clue, Ken Loach, to your choice. The Diggers' Song, recorded there by Leon Russellson, is a 17th century ballad which was originally penned, the words, not the music, by your choice of Great Live Today. Tell us, whom have you chosen?
Well, my choice is Gerard Winstanley. He was one of the leaders of the Diggers. The Diggers were a revolutionary group in the Civil War in the 1640s. The people who fought the war were the common people. But the common people didn't benefit from the revolutionary change that happened in the war. But in the chaos of war, new ideas sprang up. So in a sense, there was a revolt within that revolution. The Diggers were probably as revolutionary as any, and Gerard Winstanley was their spokesman. And almost his signature phrase is the common treasury. The earth should be made a common treasury of livelihood to whole mankind. And that's the center of what he stands for. The treasury of the earth. Why don't we share it equally? And why don't we work it together in harmony? And I think he lives because his words ring out with such clarity and are now so prescient.
Words like diggers, levelers, true levelers, fly around. Can you distinguish the diggers from the others?
Well, the levelers were the main group that began to demand rights for the common people. They were very strong in the army. But they said, why are we fighting? We're going to get nothing out of this. And they were the left wing, as it were, within the parliamentary struggle. But when Cromwell had won, he turned on them. And out of that frustration, a lot of other groups emerged, one of whom was the Diggers, and they were a small group. But their idea was, the land belongs to the people. We will dig it up to demonstrate our ownership.
There was a 1975 film called Winstanley, directed by Kevin Brownlow. The script was based on Winstanley's writings, and we have a clip from it. Let's listen to this.
The work we are going about is this: to dig up George's Hill and the waste ground thereabouts, and to sow corn and eat our bread together by the sweat of our brows, that we may work in righteousness and lay the foundation of making the earth a common treasury for all, both rich and poor. That everyone that is born in the land may be fed by the earth his mother that brought him forth, according to the reason that rules in the creation. Not enclosing any part into any particular hand, but all as one man, working together and feeding together, as sons of one father, members of one family, not one lording over another, but all looking upon each other as equals in the creation.
In this version, he sounds a bit posh and guileless.
He's a lad from Wigan. I mean,
how would you portray him?
You'd find someone who had convictions, who was credible. You just find someone who's credible. We were at a Diggers Festival on Saturday in Wigan, and great event it is. And there are lots of good people from Wigan there who I think would make a good Winstanley.
Joining us in the studio is Emeritus Professor of Early Modern History, Anne Hughes. Anne, Winstanley was born in Wigan. Is there much else we know about his early life?
Well, we know that he came from a sort of relatively modest family in Wigan.
When was he born?
He was born in 1609.
Yes.
And then he was apprenticed in London, became a freeman of the Merchant Tailors Company, and had a rather unremarkable life, as far as we can tell, buying cloth wholesale to sell. And the first we really know about him is 1643, when he went bankrupt. One of his customers defaulted on his debts, and that meant that Winstanley, who'd been a householder in London, paying taxes, probably supporting Parliament against the King in the Civil War, and had to sell up and moved with the help of his father-in-law to Cobham in Surrey.
So he had married by then?
He'd married a woman called Susan, who was the daughter of a relatively prosperous, well-known surgeon, who, when Winstanley's business failed, seems to have helped him out, and he moved to a modest landowning role in Cobham in Surrey.
Can you paint for us a picture of the social context?
Well, there was a war, and there were wounded soldiers. There were all the turmoil of a civil war. Alongside that, it appeared a great poverty. There were evictions from the land, but feudal tenure was challenged, security of tenure. Enclosures, so the people couldn't graze their one cow or sheep. So that brought poverty. There were also very poor harvests. And in fact, at the time, there was a record of the poor in London being fed corn and coal. Extreme poverty.
As Ken has said, is one of the hardest periods in recorded English history. But it's also a time of almost exhilaration and hope for radical people. The struggle between the King and Parliament begins as a struggle within the propertied class about the power of the King, the law, the church. But Parliament also presents itself in printed propaganda as fighting as the representative of the people for the people's liberty. And in January 1649, the people of England publicly try and execute their king. So the king has fallen in an unprecedentedly public way. So it's exhilaration in a period of social unrest and economic crisis.
It's no surprise to me that you've chosen someone whose drama unfolds against a backdrop of poverty and power and also hope. These are three themes that you've been drawn to, I think, all your life.
Well, absolutely, yes. Because I think what strikes you if you're engaged in politics or films or trying to make sense of the world is the gross inequality, the gross injustice, the class struggle, as some of us would call it. And the possibilities.
And what else did his pamphlets, when he started writing them, say?
It challenges any notion that you need an organised national church, compulsory national church. It's about your own spiritual journeys, your own spiritual identification with Christ. And he has a very radical conception of religion. He calls God the great spirit reason. He's a very, very vivid pro-stylist.
He certainly is.
Yeah. Right. I mean, that's why he's the voice that comes down to us from the 17th
yes,
century.
Yes.
It's his voice, because he has images and a simple eloquence and a clarity.
Yeah.
And he refers back to the Bible, as 17th century politics was conducted in the language of the Bible and over religious struggle as well.
I think, am I wrong, Ken, that it's a little bit more than just his language? It threads through all his writing. What is Winstanleyism if you subtract religion from it?
I think he would be called a communist now. He certainly wouldn't get in the Labour Party, that's for sure. along with the Pope, of whom more later. But I think that's the essence of it. It's a view of history that private property was derived from the sword. And there's also a sense that our strength is unity, is working together, and that property divides us. Property brings wars, it brings contention, it brings division, and that is no way to value the earth. And what is extraordinary about Winstanley is you can hear David Attenborough there. You can hear David Attenborough there. I have no idea what his politics are, and they're irrelevant. But he is saying we have to value the common treasury. And we are at a point at which we haven't valued it so consistently, and Winstanley would argue, and I would support him, that that is because we have fought over it through the struggle for property and wealth.
I think he's also interesting in that he connected a sort of spiritual moral transformation in individuals with this collective valuing and working together of the natural world, that private property had corrupted people morally, as well as being obviously socially divisive. So he does have this vision that goes back to the Christian accounts of the fall, that people would be transformed when the divisions and contests over the natural world would be at an end.
Yes, I mean the idea of common ownership and equality goes back a long way, and in a way, Winstanley was echoing John Bull from the Peasant Revolt of 1381, and when Adam delved and Eve span, who was then the gentleman? Can I just read this
please
quote
do.
from Winstanley? In the beginning of time, the great Creator made the earth to be a common treasury to preserve beasts, birds, fishes, and man. Not one word was spoken in the beginning that one branch of mankind should rule over another. And it is that sense that class division is made by man. It's not inherent.
He wanted to get rid of buying and selling as well, didn't he, Anne?
Oh, yes. He says the cheating art of buying and selling in his autobiographical passages. He said, you know, he'd been a freeman of London with a good business, but the cheating art of buying and selling had, plus the demands of war, had caused his bankruptcy. I mean, he was a buyer and seller, inevitably, in the world he had to live in, but he was against it, and he, in 1652, he published The Law of Freedom in a platform, which was a sort of general program for a sort of collective egalitarian society where people worked at their particular labors, but there was a common storehouse in each community. And you just went and, you know, if you needed clothes or food or whatever, you just went and got what you needed.
I think there's obviously a utopian sense, and particularly when you're trying to invent a constitution for a revolution that hasn't happened, that it can become fanciful to me. So I think, you know, I'd part company with him at that point. But I think the essence of what he's saying has lasted.
We've been talking about his words and his writing, Anne, but he wanted to be a man of action, and was.
Yes, he said, my mind was not at rest because nothing was acted, and thoughts ran in me that words and writings were all nothing and must die, for action is the life of all, and if thou dost not act, thou dost nothing. So probably on April the 1st, 1649, Winstanley with others, as he says, took my spade and went and broke the ground upon George Hill in Surrey. As we know now, it's a gated estate, St George's Hill in Surrey. And it's interesting that they're claiming the common lands for their own as an example of what collective working of the land can do. They're not invading, you know, private property. They're trying to start with the common lands that belong to the commoners. So a group begins in Walton-on-Thames in April 1649.
I think it's important to say that it had two functions. It was, on the one hand, it was needed for hunger. They needed to plant for hunger, as we said. But also it was a symbol that the land belonged to the people. So it had two functions.
I'm just thinking of St. George's Hill today, with the gated community, as you say, Anne, and the luxury mansions and the golf courses. What do you think he'd think of it if he saw it now?
Well, I think it's half time and we're 1-0 down at the moment. And we've got to get our act together.
Did the digging spread? And were there more occupations?
Well, they lasted in Walton and were driven out eventually by hostile local people and moved nearby Cobham and lasted a bit longer in Cobham. They were again driven out. So the whole thing in Surrey lasts about a year. But towards the end, in early 1650, there are signs that there are diggers in Buckinghamshire, in Wellingborough, in Northamptonshire. There may be a community in Kent. And as the diggers are threatened in Surrey, they go on a sort of support-raising tour and money-raising tour of, I suppose we'd call it, the home counties and the South Midlands. So there are manifestos from Ivor in Buckinghamshire that echo Winstanley's language, probably not written by him, but his words that influence them. So there are signs that the communities spread.
Do you think, Ken, that these occupations were meant as the beginning of a revolution, or were they just an illustration?
I think they were serious. I mean, this was, I mean, imagine the country. Everything is up for grabs. You know, the king has gone. The class that he represents has crumbled. Who is going to take power? No, it was a volatile situation. I think they meant business. I think it's easy to dismiss Winstanley and the diggers as dreamers. I challenge that. And I think his idea was that common ownership of the land would be efficient. And he wrote this: if the wasteland of England were manured, i.e. cultivated, by her children, it would become, in a few years, the richest, the strongest, and most flourishing land in the world. And think back to the Second World War. When we needed to be efficient, what did we do? The mines went into public ownership and control. The railways were controlled. Munitions, my father worked in the munitions factory, taken over and planned and controlled. Yep. And I think that idea that of efficiency is, it means he's not just dreaming of some utopia. This is concrete.
The Tory side of me would say, ah, yes, but what about collective farms? Did that work?
Well, the thing is how you organise it, isn't it? It doesn't mean the system's bad. Otherwise, the corporate power would be well gone, wouldn't they?
I think if you see him in his context, he clearly intended it to have an effect. He was not himself destitute, so he was not driven by immediate difficulties himself, though he could see them all around him. But he certainly intended it to be a practical example that others would follow. I do have to say, though, that there are relatively small numbers. They're harassed out of their communities, but they're not, I think, as practical a threat to the authorities as, say, the levellers were with their allies in the army. And the leveller mutinies that happen about the same time as the diggers, they're put down by force.
There's a lot of talk of eating together.
Yes,
your latest
yes.
film, Ken, The Old Oak, also makes the point that people should eat together. Now, this programme's going out just before the film's released, so don't tell us too much. But that is an important theme for you, isn't it, eating together?
Yes. Well, it was very prominent in the miners' strike, again, where there was poverty, people needed food, and the food kitchens became celebrated. They brought people together, and the eating together was a mark of solidarity. There's a very good quote from Winstanley. Can I find
yes,
it for you? Yes, here we are. This is what Winstanley says about solidarity. Work together, eat bread together. He that works for another, either for wages or to pay him rent, works unrighteously. But they that are resolved to work and eat together, making the earth a common treasury, doth join hands with Christ to lift up the creation from bondage. In other words, selling your labour where someone else will make a profit from it is a kind of bondage. But to liberate the world, you have to do it together. And he links that to God's plan, I guess. Others would link it to just common justice or whatever. But that's a powerful idea.
It's a period where people, small landowners and small businessmen, as Winstanley was, are very anxious about lapsing into a dependence on wage labour. He's not in favour of a violent struggle. He says, I do not mean act by the sword, but take plough and spade, build and plant, and make the wasteland fruitful. But yes, working for hire, either giving hire or taking hire, is immoral, corrupting.
And kind of just the most extraordinary connection to that. May I read you something else? Now, these words will ring a bell for anybody who joined the Labour Party before Blair. Hear Gerard Wynne Stanley in this. It was in my Labour Party card. The aim is to secure for the workers by hand and by brain the full fruits of their industry and the most equitable distribution thereof that may be possible upon the basis of the common ownership of the means of production and exchange. The point is the same as Wynne Stanley's. Why should you not receive the full value of your work, either in a social wage or in the physical wage you get on a Friday? Why should someone else cream some of it off? And that Wynne Stanley called it unrighteous. The Labour Party was formed with that intention. And, of course, the great tragedy of the Labour Party is not one leader has believed in it until Jeremy Corbyn.
But now, Ken, as a film director, you presumably have to boss people around a bit. Do you all share the proceeds equally of the films you make?
Well, we have to produce a commodity. We don't have the money to make it on the basis of we can't be diggers in that sense, because we have to raise money. And the people who lend you money are making a commodity, and it has to be structured in that way. But you don't boss people around. That's something else. I work with good people who would tell me to get lost if I did. No, we work. We share ideas and work and listen to each other.
Let me give you a quote, Ken, which rather surprised me, from The Law of Freedom in a Platform. If they prove desperate, wanton, or idle, and will not quietly submit to the law, the taskmaster is to feed them with short diet and to whip them, for a rod is prepared for the fool's back, till such time as their proud hearts do bend to the law. If any have so highly broke the laws as they come within the compass of whipping, imprisoning, and death, the executioner shall cut off the head, hang or shoot to death, or whip the offender according to the sentence of law. Now, Ken, forgive this old reactionary, but does this progression from, in his youth, a philosophy of kindness and sharing and equality to a philosophy of command, some would say tyranny, does it not stand as a kind of parable, like Animal Farm, for what happens to the communist impulse?
No, well, you're smiling as you said, and of course no one would follow him down that path. But it was a time of when being executed was not uncommon, and it's probably unwise to expect somebody in the mid-17th century to turn into someone who was against corporal punishment in schools. But he did say, also, he said something that's a surprisingly liberal you might approve of. He suggested education equal both men and women, and he said marriage should be civil. Now, that's progressive by our standards, never mind the 17th century. So I think the progressive didn't die entirely.
Have we any idea what he looked like? There are engravings, pictures, but they were just from the imagination.
They're from the imagination. Yes. He was not. We do, for instance, have woodcuts of the famous Leveller leader, John Lilburn, but Wynne Stanley never quite got that sort of press notoriety. So I don't think we have any idea.
Do you have a picture of him in your mind? Not just how he looked, but do you think he was a nice man?
You see, I think he would, because of what he said about solidarity and the joy of working together, the joy of being engaged in a common struggle. And I think that's underestimated by people who've not really been part of it. You know, if you're standing alongside people, you're convinced of the justice of your cause. The sheer comradeship, joy, fellowship, jokes, laughter, is unparalleled, because everyone is up against it. Everyone believes in what they're doing, and you have a common enemy. And that's a recipe for friendship, really.
And what happened to Wynne Stanley following the fizzling out, as it were, of his revolution?
Well, he briefly worked for a person that we don't have time to talk about, really, a radical prophetess called Lady Eleanor Davis, helping her with the harvest. But after 1652 and the publication of the Law of Freedom in a Platform, he seems to have returned to a quiet, conventional life. living between London and Cobham. He seems to have been a relatively substantial member of Cobham society, often described as a gentleman, acting as a church warden and a local administrator.
A bit disappointing, isn't it?
Well, can I just yes. also say he was a Quaker?
Yes.
He died a Quaker, and the Quakers were a much more subversive and aggressive group than the Quakers of our own time. Mm. Marries again a younger woman, Elizabeth Stanley, and his first marriage was childless, but has two sons who die quite young. And then he dies as a Quaker in London in 1676.
Ken, I do get that there is something so moving, so elemental about this, an inspiration to ages beyond his own age. But the practicalities, do you think that movement in 17th century could have been pivotal if Winstanley had succeeded? Could he have changed the course of history then?
I think it's unlikely. I think in conventional radical thinking, the revolutionary class in the 17th century was the class that allowed the Industrial Revolution to take place. And the merchants, the new industrialists, the progressive farmers who wanted to use their land without feudal ties to impede it, they were the revolutionary class. That was the progressive thing to happen for Cromwell and his ilk to win. The question now is that still the revolutionary class, or have they reached a stage in which all that is happening is destruction? Can they still be allowed to maintain power? I mean, I think that's the political question that's left. Listen to the Pope.
Yeah.
Listen to Pope Francis. He talks about unbridled pursuit of profit as the dung of the devil. He talks about rereading the gospel, celebrating the gospel in the same way that the radicals did the 17th century, including Winstanley. I'm not religious, but to celebrate the sense of man's collective joy in this creation. And the dung of the devil, referred to by the Pope, makes sense when we look at the mess in which we're leaving the planet for our future generations.
Listening to you, Ken, that the passion, the enthusiasm, makes me think there must be another film in you. Couldn't you make a better film about Winstanley?
I wouldn't criticise anybody's films because it's hard work to make it. Are there many films to make? Yes, that's one. I wish you need another lifetime. But Winstanley left two a couplet at the end. Maybe finish
please
with that.
Yes.
When these clay bodies are in grave and children stand in place, this shows we stood for truth and peace and freedom in our days.
My thanks to Ken Loach and to Professor Anne Hughes for celebrating the life of Gerard Winstanley. Goodbye.